We want to introduce Cindy Domingo, chair of our Cuba and Bolivarian Issue Committee, to report on her committee's work on statements about U.S. interference in Venezuela and media coverage of Venezuela, and about any developments in your Cuba work, too. Cindy, you've got 3 minutes. Please be sure to let our members know when the next meeting of your committee will be and how we can get involved.
Okay, our next meeting is Monday, May 13th at 4:30 in the afternoon, and we'll be sending out an announcement about that, and we'll be reporting on our work that's happening. In the next few weeks, both Jan Stroud, an active member of our committee, and myself will be leading two different delegations to Cuba. Jan's theme is advancing women's health and human rights, and will be going from May 3rd through the 12th. And I will be leading a delegation that will march in the May Day March and attend an international solidarity conference with workers' brigades from all over the world. We feel that it's very important for U.S. peoples to continue to travel to Cuba because of recent successful efforts by the Trump administration to turn back much of the work that had been accomplished under the Obama administration to take some initial steps in normalizing relations with Cuba. The Trump administration has been trying again to isolate Cuba. And many people from the United States are afraid to travel to Cuba once again. And so we think that these two delegations will contribute to educating U.S. peoples on the reality of the lives of people in Cuba and work towards normalizing relations again. From the April e-news, if you read it, you can see that the recent attempt, successful attempt by Trump to further strengthen the blockade. And this goes hand in hand with the strengthening of sanctions against Venezuela, Iran, Nicaragua, and other countries in which the strengthening of the sanctions only hurts the ordinary citizens of these countries. And so the Trump administration allowed what was called Title III of the Helms-Burton Act to go into effect for at least 6 months, which allowed U.S. peoples to sue the Cuban government over losses of properties, resources that were taken during the Cuban, right after the Cuban revolution. This is against international law, and the Cuban government offered to repay people for the loss of their properties, but the United States refused to accept any compensation. So the Title III that has been allowed to be implemented will hurt the Cuban economy further, hurt the Cuban citizens, and is very devastating to the economy of Cuba. The other thing that will take place in June and July of this year is the Pastors for Peace caravan. And so we will be reporting on those after they come back in July. And then just lastly, in terms of our Venezuela work, we continue to promote the national actions that are happening. There's another one coming up in soon, and we'll be continuing to issue e-alerts because don't be fooled that just because it may have disappeared from some from the media, the U.S. is still waging its war vigorously against Venezuela for regime change. So thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. That was a very, very good report. Continuing with reports on the facts of what's happening in Venezuela, our president, Darien Dalou, was recently in Caracas with a coalition of peace organizations for a firsthand look at what is happening there. Darian, can you tell us a little about the trip you took, what organizations were part of the coalition, and what you observed? You've got up to 15 minutes, and we'll have questions and answers at the end. Be ready with your questions for both Darian or Cindy after this. Your mic is open, Darian.
Thank you. And I was expecting we would have our solidarity discussion first, so my apologies for not being right on the minute with all the information. I did want to say a little bit in background about the situation in Venezuela right now. There are so many issues around the U.S. involvement or U.S. attacks on Venezuela. And because there are so many issues, I am glad that Cindy Domingo and the Cuba and the Bolivarian Alliance Issue Committee is paying attention to this area. I thank them for their recent item in the e-news. And I expect that Venezuela will be one of the items that is important in the elections in 2020. Because it's going to be a potential issue in the elections, it's possible we'll talk a little bit about Venezuela issues on the program committee conference call on May 7th. So I want to remind all the listeners to this call that all WILTS members are invited to the conference call of the program committee on Tuesday, May 7th, which is at 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern time. In terms of scant time, that's what I have to present this report right now. Even reporting on my 4 days with the delegation would be a challenge, but there's far more going on with Venezuela than just what I learned on the delegation. Nonetheless, I'm accustomed to not having a lot of time. The whole situation around this delegation was very rushed. I had just been elected in the middle of January. When in February, about mid-February, I first got word that this was a possibility, and we were busily filling leadership positions with our many ad hoc committees in WILF, and we still have those ad hoc committees. If anyone is interested in being on a national committee, I'd be glad to hear from them. But all of that was going on when the Venezuela situation erupted. When I heard about the delegation by the peace movement leaders in the United States, I was extremely excited because this was a coalition effort, and it reflects the efforts of a coalition to have a more united peace movement. That's very important as we come into the elections. Our delegation consisted of about a dozen people, and we came from a number of groups. Of course, I was with WILF. We also had two folks from Veterans for Peace, the president, Barry Condon, and also Dan Shi. We had a person from the Canadian Peace Congress. From Popular Resistance, we had Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese. Additionally, Sarah Flounders, who's been active in many things, was part of the movement. Also, Ajamu Baraka, who's involved with the Black Alliance for Peace and had been a candidate for Green Party president. And additionally, we had people from Women Against Military Madness, and independent reporter whose name suddenly escapes me, Eva Bartlett. So we had a wonderfully diverse delegation. I think one of the most challenging problems for activists in this country is to understand that so much of what we see in the media and certainly hear from the government about Venezuela is really a pack of lies. there are multiple attacks being conducted by the U.S. against Venezuela, and the campaign of lies is probably one of the most destructive. However, also the U.S. appears, of course it's very difficult to get accurate or detailed information, but appears to be supporting the terrorist attacks of bombings and burnings of components of the electrical system in Venezuela. And the blackouts in the Venezuelan electrical system, the major blackouts, are very likely the result of cyber or electromagnetic or other attacks by the United States. Now, people will say very reasonably, what proof do you have? People say that those electrical blackouts are just caused by lack of maintenance and lack of experts. It is certainly true that a lot of the more expert technicians have lost Venezuela in the face of the terrible economic conditions there, in large part because of the U.S. sanctions, and particularly so with the January 2019 Bush sanctions. At the same time, in looking at and trying to figure out what is true with what's happening with Venezuela, I think people really have to look at the historic record, particularly the record of the United States in Latin America. The U.S. has repeatedly intervened to overthrow elected governments. Most recently, of course, the U.S. backed the coup d'etat in Honduras in 2007. Also, the U.S. backed a coup d'etat that was there in Venezuela in 2002. And back in 1973, the U.S. backed a coup d'etat in Chile. And the historic memory that is hard to find in the United States is very important here, because the situation of Chile, which was the first Marxist regime in South America after Cuba, the way the U.S. attacked the Chilean government is very similar to what's happening now with Venezuela. The U.S. started with economic sanctions. Then in June of 73, there was an attempted coup d'etat. And later in 73, the Chamber of Deputies, an elected body, had a majority vote calling on the military to restore order. I compare this to the elected body in Venezuela, their assembly, and the way that assembly has become dominated by more conservative voters. So all of these kinds of things are in the playbook of how the U.S. seeks to subvert elected governments. And I say elected government because I think that's a very important point which gets lost in the campaign of what I have to call lies going on in the United States. You don't have to listen to Fox News to hear Chile being called a dictatorship, the President Maduro, the elected president, being called a tyrant. But there was an election. There have been repeated elections in Venezuela. So why is the U.S. going after Venezuela? Well, okay, I'll tell you what I think are some of the answers, but I also want to look at the answers the U.S. claims to be the case. Of course, Venezuela is the largest producer of oil in the largest reserves of oil in the world, and the United States government wants to get that oil for U.S. corporations, or more accurately, for transnational corporations that influence the U.S. government. But also, the U.S. is very concerned about the model that Venezuela offers, which is a model in which the government is seeking to support lower-income people, the bulk of the population. The U.S. is working in Venezuela with this self-appointed, self-announced person, Guaido, who is from the upper class elite upper class. He's white. This is in a country, Venezuela, that's approximately 77% people of color. Now, the quality of life in Venezuela right now is not as good as the people have every right to expect. The economy is terrible. People can't get all the goods they want. But I saw no indications of starvation when I was there. I saw food on the shelves in stores, people eating snacks in the street, sales of hot dogs and pizza going on around me. However, the U.S. insists that the quality of life is terrible and that we wanted to give humanitarian aid to Venezuela. This at the same time that Trump is cutting off humanitarian aid to Central America. I compare Venezuela quality of life to the quality of life in El Salvador and say again, how can the U.S. really contend that we are intervening in Venezuela for the good of the people when we don't intervene in El Salvador or Guatemala, to say nothing of Saudi Arabia? Another interesting factor in Venezuela is that they have had 200 years of peace. Now, I think that's a threat to the United States. It's not only that the government of Venezuela is seeking to use the profits from the sales of natural resources, namely oil. They're using those profits to benefit the common people and to help the poor. That's a threat. But 200 years of peace in itself may be a threat because, of course, the U.S. is currently engaged in endless war. The idea that countries could live at peace is very threatening to our war industry. The other countries that our current president named as part of the terrible threat were Nicaragua and Cuba. I think it's obvious from these three countries that none of them is a real threat to the United States. What they offer are alternatives to the government that we have that apparently our president wants to stomp out. So as you're trying to decide what is the truth, how can I find accurate information, I again encourage you to look at the history of the U.S. in Latin America and the history of the media in the United States and how it has distorted issues time and time again. I also call on you to pay attention to the race issues represented by the country of Venezuela, a majority of color country, being attacked by the country of the United States, and for the United States to be backing a regime that is so white and so upper class. Just an interesting note, I'm using figures from the Encyclopedia Britannica when I say that the country is approximately 77% of color. That's adding together the two-thirds of the country that's mestizo, that is of European ancestry and indigenous ancestry or black ancestry, plus the actual 10% of the population that is black. A substantial proportion of Venezuela is European, about one-fifth of the country. However, it's a very mixed-race country. So that's my time of 15 minutes, and I'll turn it back to Sandy or whomever.
Thanks, Darian. If you have questions for Darian or Cindy about what's happening in Venezuela, Cuba, and the NATO incursion into Latin America, or about any next steps Will proposes, please press number 1 on your phone keypad right now. That's number 1 on your phone to get on a stack.
It was an excellent report, Darian. Thank you very much. I think it's wonderful that you were able to go to Venezuela representing Wealth, not only so that our members could have this firsthand report, but it's kind of a coup that Wilf took its place among all these other very well-established and well-known peace organizations. So thank you for representing us. I have a question from Jean Verthain in New York City. Go ahead, Jean.
Hi, I'm actually in Portland, Oregon right now, taking care of my grandkids, and congratulations on yours. Anyway, I just wanted to say, I speak as somebody who was in a political bombing during the Chilean coup d'etat in the 1970s. So this is a very vehement issue for me. So, and I want to praise Darian for, on the spot, going to Venezuela. I just wanted to ask, because there was a lot of wonderful information reported, and I am very familiar with the coup d'etats, or relatively speaking, including Iran, but the one that is very important right now is a sort of emerging one attempted in Venezuela. But what was interesting to me were the reports of what programs actually existed, and the fact that you said that there isn't this destitution that somehow the U.S. media is portraying over and over again like a drumbeat. And I find this even on the left, people are asking, and this is why I'm asking for, you know, more detail if possible. In my sanctuary group, which is a very good activist, wonderful activist grouping of people who do vigiling every week, they have a lot of questions about Venezuela because they're affected, as we all are, by what the U.S. is saying and some very legitimate outlets are saying. So what's interesting to me is that there are housing programs attempted, there are daycare programs attempted, education is broadened. And so if you can speak to anything about the programmatic aspects that are attempted, even with all the U.S. sanctions, I'd appreciate it. And then again, thanks, Darian.
Thank you for the question, Jean. It's a very important one, because Maduro and, I don't know to what extent, but probably Chavez have both been blamed for fiscal mismanagement because they chose to invest a large amount of the profits from oil sales into programs to improve the lives of the poor. When I was in Venezuela, I saw a number of great big high-rise buildings in downtown Venezuela that have been constructed by the government to offer improved housing, low-income housing, for poor people. That was very striking to those of us, all of us coming from the United States, except for a couple of Canadians, being well aware of the lack of money going to low-income housing in the U.S. In addition to housing, education was greatly expanded for poor people so that many had, for the first time, the opportunity to really access quality education. Schools were improved and more young people were brought into the schools. Healthcare was expanded. Indeed, our President Trump complained about Venezuela sending oil to Cuba. Well, Cuba and Venezuela have an agreement to exchange Venezuelan oil for Cuban doctors. Those doctors serve in clinics. We saw clinics all over town, neighborhood clinics that at this point are especially focusing on preventive medicine because, very sadly, Venezuela is not able to afford very much in the way of pharmaceutical medicine. This is a real problem for the people of Venezuela. Something like insulin is terribly, terribly expensive. The cost of medicine is driven by multiple factors. One is the severe hyperinflation that has taken place has made the Venezuelan peso worth far, far, far less. Now, there's reason to think that there's some artificial manipulation of the currency, at least when the inflation started. In any case, what it does is what a dollar, just for us to be able to identify with what's going on, what you could buy for a dollar at one time, if the dollar suffered from hyperinflation, then that same product would cost $100. how many of us would be able to afford medications if the prices went up 100 times? This is unfortunately what's happening with medications in Venezuela, complicated by the fact that pharmaceutical companies are restricting their shipments of medications to Venezuela. And then all of this is complicated by the fact that the U.S. used to be the major oil trading partner of Venezuela. About 70% of their oil went to the U.S. Well, right now the U.S. is still selling some Venezuela oil and taking the money and putting it into a restricted bank account, which they have said they are giving to Guaido, the pretender president. However, the country of Venezuela was relying on the income from sales of oil in order to have foreign exchange capital. The other trading partners for Venezuela, there are some sales in South America, but China and Russia are their main other oil purchasers. Both those countries buy vast amounts of oil. However, both China and Russia have huge loans to Venezuela, so that when Venezuela sends some oil, Venezuela gets no cash back. A country cannot buy pharmaceuticals without cash, and right now the cash is totally cut off. The U.S. has cut off sales of oil from Venezuela to the United States, oil from the nationalized oil company. But I got a little far afield. So in Venezuela, they're doing preventive medicine because they can't help people very much if folks actually get sick. So there's education, there's medicine. Additionally, the government has extended water and electrical service to far more people, and they have extended voting to far more people. Even though voting was theoretically mandatory before Hugo Chavez's government was elected 20 years ago, in the current period, where voting is optional, voluntary, far more people are voting than ever voted back when it was mandatory. So those are some examples: healthcare, education, housing, public transit, electricity, access to safe drinking water have all been provided by the current government. And many of those are deeply threatened by what's happening now. All the blackouts wipe out, or they shut down the metro in Caracas, which people relied on to get to work. The metro was actually free at this time because the inflation in Venezuela was so bad that the cost of paper to print metro tickets exceeded the value of the tickets. In addition to the metro being shut down, imagine being on the 35th floor of a building and no elevator service, especially if you are elderly or infirm. Also, you would have no water because the pumps were unable to run to pump water. This was the big blackout that occurred only a couple of days after Guaido had made statements along the lines of, "You will live in darkness if you don't support my movement." So there's a lot
of... We also have a question from Robin Lloyd. Robin, go ahead.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much, Darian. This is fascinating what you've been telling us. I'd like to just contribute something to what Howie and Cindy were talking about in terms of the Green New Deal, because I got this mailing from IFCO, which is Pastors for Peace, about Cuba and what a socialist government can do in terms of climate change. Cuba has a 100-year plan to combat the effects of climate change. A decade in the making, the program bans construction of new homes in threatened coastal areas, mandates relocating people from communities doomed by rising sea levels, and calls for an overhaul of the country's agricultural system to develop drought-resistant farming techniques and shift crop production away from saltwater-contaminated areas. And it goes on and on, but it's just to say all the fear of socialism here in the United States, is justified in a way, because socialism will require, to be effective in climate change and protecting us from climate change, we will need a more effective government, and that would be a more socialist government. So that's all I wanted to contribute tonight.
Well, just picking up the thread of that, obviously, for someone like Trump, who continues to deny climate change, a socialist government that prepares seriously for climate change is a big threat. I also just want to mention that in Caracas, when we were there, we had the chance to see several urban agriculture projects. Now, urban agriculture is a serious way to address climate change, because it brings food to the people, reducing the cost for transportation. Also, the projects we saw were all organically done instead of introducing lots of chemicals. We saw people growing tomatoes and other produce, and we saw them raising rabbits for their protein supplies. And these were all in areas of low-income people who need to find ways to supplement their diets in a way that they can afford. I also left out that there is a food program in Venezuela where boxes of staples are provided on a periodic basis, monthly or every other month, to low-income people at enormously reduced prices. And the government invests huge amounts of money in that, even though they don't have huge amounts of money. So thank you for the question, Robin.
Next is Jane Doyle. Jane, go ahead.
Thank you. And thank you, Darian, for your report. I'm really getting a strong image of at least what's happening in Caracas, as well as the intent and effort at the national level. What the question I have is going to sound a little weird, because I believe what you're saying, but about people in the city having food. But I'm wondering about the rural areas, and sometimes, of course, people are, and also the other services like medical care. As I was in Venezuela when Chavez was in power, and a lot of what you're talking about I saw going on, and I'm so happy to hear it's improved. But when we went into rural areas to visit, it didn't look as good, although there were efforts being made. So I'm wondering, was there anyone in your group or any aspects where people talked about the rural poverty and what is happening to under all these plans in the rest of Venezuela?
I want to just tell you what I know, which is not a lot. On the one hand, I chanced to talk to someone who had family in rural Venezuela, and I asked that person about how their family was doing, and this was a middle-income or lower family. They said that they didn't have a problem getting food in the rural areas, because that's where food is grown, so that it's more available. In terms of the poverty in the rural areas, one of the big issues in Venezuela is that the elite classes own most of the land. There have been some efforts under the current administration to do land redistribution so that poor people would have access to land and could farm it. Unfortunately, when we heard about these land redistribution efforts, we were also told that hundreds of the people who got land redistributed to them had been subsequently killed by paramilitary forces of the large landowners. That's a very discouraging situation, and I would fault the government for not better protecting the new landowners who were trying to farm their redistributed land. So obviously there are some deep ingrained problems in a country that had lived under a very divided system for a couple of hundred years before the election of Chavez and subsequently Maduro. Thank you.
I'd like to just add something to go along with that. A lot of the labor groups and the groups that formed in Honduras and were able to get land from the large landowners have had the exact same experience, with many of the men being killed. So unfortunately, it's widespread.
I will say that in the rural areas, as in the cities, my understanding is the Cuban doctors are there, because that's a very successful project between Cuba and Venezuela.
Thank you.
Okay, we also have a question from Lorna Paisley, and I think that'll be our last question tonight.
No. Actually, I don't have a question. I have a comment. I know most of these things Darian has said because I get a lot of information from independent journalists on YouTube. So if you want to keep up, you might go. They show you the color of the skin of the people who are doing whatever in Venezuela. And also one of the things that wasn't mentioned is all the gold that England has that they won't give to them to spend. And I heard the other day that China and Russia are sending medicine to Venezuela now. So good for them. I find myself cheering for Russia and China someday, so I don't know what to say. But anyway, I think you can learn a lot at YouTube. Just search Venezuela and independent journalists, and you'll find out a lot of things. That's it. Thanks.
And to finish up, I think Cindy Domingo had a question. Go ahead, Cindy.
No, actually, I had a few comments in the conversation. I think we have to remember that Venezuela is not a socialist country. That in fact the majority of the economy is still held in private hands, which is why there's such difficulty in the economy. Mm-hmm. What we see in Venezuela is an economic crisis, which is only worsened by the sanctions. We don't have a humanitarian crisis, and we have to make that distinction. There's a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. That's why you don't see people starving in the streets in Venezuela. They are having difficulty with medicines, with food, etc., but they're not having a humanitarian crisis. The third point is that there are, in addition to the economic crisis, there are very severe concerns about the management under Maduro. I mean, this is a big controversy within the left about whether or not Maduro should be replaced and having elections to replace him. There has been corruption, but to remember that when the price of oil plunged, and that was orchestrated in part to drive the economy of Venezuela down. When the price of oil plunged, that had a drastic effect on the Venezuelan economy. When you have that kind of economic crisis with the downturn of the oil prices, you cannot keep up the rate of providing these social services to the vast majority of the poor people in Venezuela. And so there had to be some kind of readjustment, as well as when the IMF and the World Bank refuses to deal when Venezuela couldn't deal on the world market with those financial organizations. So there's a lot of concerns about the economy of Venezuela, but I think for us in the United States to understand that we have to lift those sanctions, we have to allow the Venezuelan people to have their own self-determination, and that's the role of us in the United States to demand those things.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just wanted to emphasize that, yes, the sanctions are specious. They have no basis in terms of any legitimate concern of the United States. And, of course, Venezuela is not a socialist country. They have a number of corporations and companies operating there that generally many of them are resisting the current government and making things hard for them. And finally, it was the Saudis who decided that they would thoroughly increase their production of oil and thus drive down the price that was on the world market of oil. The Saudis, who are no paragons of a good country and yet are our powerful allies. Thank you.